Thank you for question. Exit left to Funway. Mr. President, I'd like to introduce you to
Barney.
Hello. Always glad to talk to you.
Barney.
You know, when you clock the human race with the stopwatch of history, it's a new record every time.
That's a cute story, Mr. President,
and
I...
And who loses? People like you.
Barney!
Well...
And you.
Clem.
People who are altered...
Stop, Mr. President, please stop. Now, I know it means nothing to you. I'm only a clone, but you've got such a wonderful job, and you're doing it so well. You know, we bozos have a saying. When you put on the nose,
could you state
it
that
grow-
as a question?
It grows.
Read to. Thank you very much.
Barney!
You'll be getting a handsome simulfax copy of your own words in the mail soon.
No.
And my reply.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Jeremy Braddock. He teaches literature, media, and sound studies at Cornell University, and we're continuing our conversation about his book, Firesign, The Electromagnetic History of Everything, as told on 9 comedy albums. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. I had to have you back. And I was nowhere near finished talking to you about this book.
Yeah, there's tons to talk about when it comes to Firesign Theater.
Movies made for the mind, as they say. One of the things I wanted to talk about is Firesign Theater and the politics of the time. And a lot of people today are not going to realize what was going on in America. You want to just recap that?
Oh well, that's pretty large.
Yeah. Okay. Let's there was the Vietnam War, which was huge. People may not realize that, but it affected every strata of society. Enormous protests going on, Richard Nixon was our president, which up until that point in time I thought was going to be the worst thing we were going to ever experience, but I was wrong.
I think they thought that too.
I think a lot of people did. How did Firesign Theater incorporate the politics of the time, which was so volatile, into their recorded pieces?
Well, I think it was constant, but almost always indirect. I guess I would put it. I would put it that way.
I think that's.
Just for example, probably the most famous album is "Don't Crush That Dwarf Hand Me the Pliers," which is their third record, which they recorded in May 1970, and they had been sort of working through some material on a radio program that they had on KPPC in Pasadena, which is one of the first sort of freeform commercial FM stations. So they'd been working through a number of themes, and we could definitely talk about how stuff that comes up in the news gets, filtered into Don't Crush That Dwarf. But the really key thing is that they do an East Coast tour in the spring of, in March 1970, which is their first time they had come east. And they're doing a series of interviews on WBAI, which was the Pacifica affiliate of the New York Pacifica affiliate, and they had come together on the LA Pacifica affiliate, KPFK. And more or less as they're in the studio, this is the week that the Weatherman bombing happened. So the Weatherman group is building a bomb that they're going to use to attack a military base. And the bomb blows up prematurely and destroys the house where they're building the bomb, and so this happens as they're in New York, and at the same time there's an assassination of a civil rights leader with whom one of their contacts at WBAI had a long history with, and so they're asked sort of on the air, what is the deal with your politics? And
that's a tough question,
and I think that part of the issue Also is that, of course, there's four of them, and they don't always agree on everything all the time. I mean, they're generally left and liberal, but I guess there's a difference between being left and liberal. So in any case, to bring that as to a head, they're sort of asked to account for their politics in 1970, and some of their reception in New York is that they're not being sort of directly political enough. There's a review in the Village Voice. You know, you can't be two places at once. And then they return to L.A. In the spring of 1970. And as they're in the studio, the Kent State killings happen. Like, literally, as they're recording Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. And as you'll recall, one of the things that it's sort of famously thought to be the record where they really commit to representing television. So a lot of that record is told through the switching of television channels, and you realize that the channels are sort of speaking to each other, and there's all kinds of things you could say about that. But the main thing is that the TV increasingly is switching between two old movies. So one of the things they're also thinking about is like old movie culture. And one of the movies is sort of a cheesy 1950s high school movie. It's called High School Madness. And then another one is the other film is a war movie called Parallel Hell, which is, you know, is ostensibly set in Korea, but obviously is a reference to Vietnam. And at the very end of the record, for about 30 seconds, the two movies happen simultaneously. And what they're doing is representing the school and the war together, and that was their way of saying that of representing their sympathies and their thoughts about Kent State, right? To represent the school and the war together. And so that's the type of thing. That's the type of way that they would represent the politics sort of through, I guess, what Phil Proctor would say, parables or allegorically. But rarely, you know, like Cheech and Chong actually do have a skit where they go to Vietnam. Firestein would never do anything that direct.
Well, you know, that's because I consider them performance artists, like other kinds of performance artists. And you really, as an artist, you want to shy away from the didactic. I mean, you don't want to just come out and make an obvious thing about it. But there's some weird things that happened during this time period. There was a letter, and I didn't know this until I read your book. There was a letter Phil Proctor read on KPPC FM.
Right.
From Rosemary Woods for Richard Nixon. Now, talk about that.
So evidently, so this is read on the air during those KPPC radio programs that I was telling you about. So Proctor reads this letter, which I have seen. He's not making it up. The document actually exists, in which Nixon Secretary Rosemary Woods thanks the Firesong Theater for sending Nixon a copy of their second album, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, which is also a record that indirectly refers to Vietnam, but in a way that their audience at the time instantly would have recognized.
Now you're saying that this was a real letter. This was actually sent. Yes. And by the way, for people who don't remember, Rosemary Woods, Richard Nixon's secretary, supposedly was the person responsible for the gap in the recording that everybody talked about. Yeah.
Right, the 18 and a half minute gap.
Right, right. Right.
Although that was a little bit later. Yeah, I can read
No, no, no.
Read the letter.
There's so much else to talk about.
Okay.
So that a lot of people have to have thought that was a put on.
Right. And they may have thought that the letter itself was forged, but it was a the real put on was that Nixon himself was being put on, right? So this was so presumably Firestein actually had a copy of their record sent to the White House, and surely the whole point was to solicit the very letter that Rosemary Woods did in fact send to Phil Proctor.
I find
it right? it's kind of a trophy of putting on the White House, I guess.
Well, the interesting thing is the album right after Don't Crash That Dwarf, I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus.
Yeah.
Nixon is there as an automaton.
Right.
And there's, and that I thought was very political, because every time somebody asks him a question, he does a programmed answer to it, which is in sort of this weird stand-up comic like version of Nixon's voice. But
yeah, many busy executives ask me.
Many busy executives.
Right. Yeah.
It's very bizarre. It's really, but as you mentioned, as we both talked about, I mean, they're doing political things, but it's not up front. It's in, and it's also generally sociologically political too. I mean, there's a lot of criticisms of many things. Before we get lost in that, I want to talk about, and you write a lot in different parts of the book about the Beatles.
Yes.
And Firesign. Yes. Talk to me about that, because that seems like it's a natural connection. But what was the connection between the Beatles and Firesign?
I mean, I think there's a few connections. I mean, the one you can, I guess there are two places to begin. And one would be to say, as Robert Krisko mentioned at one point, that the Beatles were the funniest rock group ever. So in addition to everything else, I think that, you know, they were in some senses, especially early on, understood as being kind of a comedy group. And I'm sure Firesign definitely saw themselves in the Beatles, and probably some of, you know, a great deal of their fans did as well. But the connection is much more explicit because on the a couple of times on the first album, and then, you know, at least a dozen times on the second album, they provide, numerous Beatles references. So, you know, like one of the characters says, my story had more holes in it than the Albert Hall.
Right,
and
right.
A character named Rocky Rococo. And, so there's, you know, all manner of references to the Beatles that take place on the second album, although notably none on the third album, which is something we could talk about.
But it's interesting. The Paul is Dead mythology. And by the way, I was part of that. I was one of those people playing the records backwards
The time.
That seemed like a Firesign skit. I mean, I felt like if somebody recorded us, it would sound like something like the Firesign Theater.
Yeah, for sure. Right. And the second album does have some backmasking on it. So there's a point where they run the tape backwards, and that's probably an idea that they got, through this culture of sort of Paul is Dead. I mean, I think that the bigger issue that really ties Firesigns and the Beatles, especially by 1969, is that sort of one of the things that happens to pop music is that people start, you know, not simply taking it seriously as like capital A art, but also in a sense, like reading records and interpreting records. So I think that sort of begins with Dylan to a certain extent, you know, reading his lyrics. But then, you know, from Rubber Soul on, the Beatles fans are really committed to interpreting the records. And I think that in a sense is, you know, part of what makes the Paul is Dead rumor is what gives it legs. And I mean, should we pause and actually describe Paul is Dead?
Yeah, if people don't remember, there was suddenly a rumor, and I can tell you because I was in college at the time.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, everybody there was all this stuff about Paul being dead, and one of them was
you remember how you found out.
It was just like a rumor, and all of a sudden it just took off, and everybody was there were all these clues in different records. There was a thing about the clothes he was wearing on certain pictures and the fact that he had bare feet on another thing. And then there was the Turn Me On Dead Man when you played number 9 backwards.
Yeah.
And so people would take their stereo turntable and literally play it backwards. And it did sound like Turn Me On Dead Man. And there was another recording that if you sped it up, it said, Paul is Dead. Now, I never got to the bottom of whether this was all really there or not. But all I know is that all these other clues were there too. And then it got really obscure, like something about the walrus was in there too. But for a period of a couple of weeks, it was crazy.
Yeah, right. And more than a couple of weeks, right? And yeah. I think you're right. So the walrus is that's a really key thing. So I think what you're thinking of is that in Glass Onion, the song Glass Onion on the White Album, like one of the lines, so the Glass Onion is a song that makes reference to other Beatles songs. Like I told you about Strawberry Fields,
right,
you know,
the
place where nothing is real. Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul.
Right.
Right. And so in a sense, you know, the Beatles are all of a sudden asking you to, you know, actually make connections among the songs. They are actually doing it, right? And so when you go back to reading the independent weekly papers from the era, there's folks who are completely convinced that Paul is really dead, right?
And oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then there's folks who are like, this is obviously BS. What are you talking about? And then there's a sort of interesting sort of third category of people who are like, of course Paul's alive, but what about all the clues they've been leaving us?
See, that's what I was. I was in that camp. The thing right. is, I knew Paul was still alive because he was making appearances. But what was weird is it did seem like all that stuff was in the records.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And in some ways it kind of is, but also it's also just material that's rich enough that you can get kind of lost in it. And I think in some ways that's a really tight connection to Firesign Theater.
Except with Firesign, often there you can decode Firesign and the meanings,
yeah.
and those are really there. I mean, it wasn't until I read the biographies of the four major Firesign Theater players in your book that I realized how wicked intelligent all four of them are. And they're putting sophisticated references in a sort of very amusing fashion on their records, most of which is going over people's heads.
Yeah, or, well, going over their heads or leaving it there to pick up the 10th or 15th time you listen to the record.
I mean, there's stuff I still don't understand on their record.
For sure.
But I want to talk about the fourth album. I think we're all bozos on this bus.
Sure.
Because I was into them. I listened to them from the first album. When I listened to Bozos, this is, first of all, the sentence sounds wild to begin with. When I listened to Bozos, it was a dark album. And you mentioned that some reviewers said that this wasn't a funny album necessarily. It was a dark album. Why is that?
It imagines a future society that's completely enclosed as if it were an amusement park run by a corporation that's totally surveilled, and in which there's no individual self-control or liberty, I suppose would be the simplest answer to that question.
Well, a lot of it was a critique of Disney World and Disneyland too, as being on the surface it's fun. It's fun, but it's an incredibly carefully controlled environment, and it still is.
Right, and Nixon had connections to Disneyland. I mean, you know, he's from Yorba Linda, which is right up the road, and his press secretary Ron Ziegler had worked at Disneyland as like a tour guide of some kind. So that's definitely one of the reference points. And then the other thing, and it's something you really do hear on the record, is that, you know, part of the way in which they represent that the space is completely surveilled is that the characters hear sort of tape recordings of things that they've said earlier on the record, sort of broadcast to them, sort of, you know, over the PA system and things like that. And that's the, you know, if the sort of one of the instigating things for Don't Crush That Dwarf was Kent State, one of the events for Bozos is that a week or two before they entered the studio to record it, was the moment that that activists broke into the FBI headquarters in Media, Pennsylvania, and revealed the extent of the COINTELPRO program, in which involved surveillance of activist groups in the United States and American citizens generally.
What I learned from your book too is about the connection, and I didn't realize this went back that far, with the chatbot Eliza, especially Eliza Doctor. A lot of people may not realize that chatbots go back to that date. I remember interacting online with Eliza, and I was totally floored. But there comes a point where Clem starts to investigate the programming of the president, and there's actually words that are used in the actual programming of Eliza.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, and actually I have to say that this is something that my students are really interested in learning about too. So the first chatbot was developed by a guy at MIT named Joseph Weizenbaum. It's called the Doctor Program, and there were different sort of scripts that you could use. The most famous of which was actually it was the Eliza program. The most famous script was called Doctor, and it sort of mimicked a psychotherapy session, and it became quite popular. And in the early days, it ran on it wasn't voice activated. You would type.
Right, you had to type. You had to type. Right, there was no voice.
And so Phil Proctor happened to interact with one of these at what he says was like a job fair in L.A. in 1970, and he absconded with printouts of the script. And so they used the printouts of the script to sort of guide the interactions with the president on the Bozos album. And then, as you said, there's also code that they draw on. And I mean, not to get too deeply into the weeds, but I talked to a couple of people who knew the programming language that Eliza Doctor worked on, and they were able to show me where Firesign was quoting it. But they were also saying that there's other computer language that they're drawing on also that's not in Eliza. So they had someone in the group or near the group was an early computer head, I think.
What was amazing as being a first-time listener is when it got to that section where there was just an awful lot of things like unhappy MacNam, and there was all these other weird noise. You had no idea what was going on. You had no clue. There were all these weird words, which as you wrote, included technical noise words. It was bizarre. Yeah. Now, as bizarre as that was, I learned from your book that Apple integrated Siri's hidden messages that refer directly to Bozos.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I actually got to talk to Tom Gruber, who is one of the product designers for Siri, who told me the backstory. And actually, the interesting thing is that the Easter egg that was in Siri until just a couple of years ago was sort of the culmination of a long series of sort of hidden things within the Mac infrastructure. So actually, unhappy MacNam was something that you could produce in sort of playing with the code in the early Mac era. And there was a word processing program in the 80s called Dr. Memory. So when Siri was introduced in, I guess, what was it, 2000? Actually, I'm going to forget this, but I think it's around 2011. If you said, this is worker speaking, hello, Siri would say, hello, Aklem. What function can I perform for
oh my
you,
God. LOL? Yeah. That would totally freak me out.
Yeah. Well, but then, you know, you would have had to have known to go look for it.
Firesign had several other albums after this and several other events. But what happened is the record became not a big thing. And that's sort of saw the downfall of Firesign as this kind of recording project.
Yeah, I mean it's a long decline, I guess you could say. And there's a lot of there, and one of the things that's interesting is that they did disappear from cultural memory quite quickly. And so one of the things that was quite striking in doing the research was to see how omnipresent they were through the mid-70s at least. But they lost their contract with Columbia Records in 1975, and they always said that, or they often said that it was because when the Vietnam War ended, they lost their audience that way. And I think that there's some truth to that, but you can also see that comedy is starting to change around that time.
Yep.
So 75 is the year that Saturday Night Live starts, which has its own sort of relationship between like rock music and comedy. And Firesign was, you know, it was comedy for the rock generation. So you could see that Saturday Night Live is doing those things in another way. HBO also starts in 1975 with its first stand-up specials. And you can also see that there's kind of a crash in the petroleum crisis of the early 70s means that records are much more expensive to produce. Now, the record industry does continue to grow in a way, but you can see that or at least I contend that with comedy records, they begin to commit to things like stand-up comedians. So like both George Carlin and Richard Pryor really are in the ascendant in the mid-70s. And those records were just simply much cheaper to produce than the Firesign records, which required, you know, lots of studio time and engineers whom you would have to pay and stuff like that. So those things all change. And then also drugs change. And I think that, you know, that Firesign Theater those are records for
grass and acid.
And, yeah, exactly. And,
not cocaine. Not cocaine.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so Lester Bangs, who was an early fan, writes a famous hit piece on them in 1975. And of course Lester Bangs wrote hit pieces on many people whom he loved.
Yeah, but he said we're going to have to end it right here. Lester Bangs wrote, and you quote him, "I no longer have the patience, the attention span, the consciousness level required to get into Firesign." And like, I think today with people getting notoriously short attention spans, it would be almost impossible. We've only scratched the surface of the book, folks, if you're listening. We've only been talking about little bits and pieces here and there. Tonight's guest is Jeremy Braddock. He teaches literature, media, and sound studies at Cornell University. And we've been talking about his book, Firesign, the electromagnetic history of everything as told on 9 comedy albums. Jeremy, it's been a real pleasure. And again, I want to emphasize for the audience, this is a really scholarly book, and there's a lot to dig into. It's been a pleasure, Jeremy.
Thanks very much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is
Mr.
Inquiry.
President,
my name's Mark Lynch.
I'd like to introduce you to
Bernie.
Hello. Always glad to talk to you.
Bernie.
You know, when you clock the human race with the stopwatch of history, it's a new record every time.
That's a cute story, Mr. President.
Who wins and who loses? People like you.
Bernie.
Well, and you.
Clem.
People who are altered.
Stop, Mr. President. Please stop. Now, I know it means nothing to you. I'm only a clone, but you've got such a wonderful job, and you're doing it so well. You know, we bozos have a saying. When you put on the nose,
could you state
it
that
grows.
As a question? Read to. Thank you very much. You'll be getting a handsome simulfax copy of your own words in the mail soon.
No.
And my reply.
By golly, Mr. President.
Thank you for a question.